What are we talking about when we call civil society organizations digitally native NGOs? These are organizations which often have little, if any, brick and mortar presence, who have lean and fairly flat organizational structures with staff all over the world, and who, importantly, primarily use digital campaigning and advocacy strategies and tactics. Think of the signing of online petitions, use of email campaigns, social media actions, etc. Think Avaaz.org, think MoveOn.org here in the US, Jatka in India, Amandla in South Africa, Compact in Germany, GetUp in Australia, Action Station in New Zealand, and many more. To what extent are these digitally native NGOs different or similar to brick and mortar NGOs? What are their strengths and weaknesses, respectively? Where do digital NGOs compete with regular ones for the eyeballs of citizens? And where are they complementary and should work together more closely than they probably are doing now? Where does online activism end and offline activism begin? And in what ways do these distinctions increasingly blur and become irrelevant? This and more we discuss in this interview with Nina Hall, professor at the Johns Hopkins University campus in Italy, and author of the 2022 book, Transnational Advocacy in the Digital Era: Think Global, Act Local. I hear some traditional NGO leaders poo-poo the rise of these actors in civil society, and I think that is to their detriment and to the detriment of maximizing impact. I've had a long-standing interest in these questions and can't wait for you to jump into this interview with me. Hello, and welcome to NGO Soul and Strategy, the podcast for NGO leaders and managers who look change right in the eye. My name is Tosca Bruno van Vijveken, and I'm the founder and principal consultant at Five Oaks Consulting. I have over three decades of experience helping leaders in civil society manage change, invest in cutting-edge leadership development, lead organizational culture change, and strengthen effectiveness. I'm also a thought leader on these issues, including as co-author of the book Between Power and Irrelevance: The Future of Transnational NGOs, which is read by civil society leaders across the globe. If you are such a leader and want to look change right in the eye, this podcast is for you. Hello, listeners. This is Tosca at NGO Soul and Strategy. I'm going to talk today with you about Transnational Advocacy in the Digital Era, a book by Nina Hall, who I will introduce in a moment. And Nina and I know each other, I think at least 5 years longer, it feels like, when I was still in academia as an what I call jokingly accidental pre-academic. And my team and I, consisting of Hans-Peter Schmitz and Michael Dedman, and we collaborated with Nina on a small research project on our end, on our team's end, in which we compared and contrasted the campaigning strategies and tactics, but also the organizational characteristics of digital NGO campaigning platforms and those of traditional NGOs. The scope of our work on this topic was quite modest compared with that of Nina and of others who know a lot more about this field. And recently, I was asked to offer a bit of support to a well-known transnational digital campaigning organization as a consultant who wished to improve their decision-making processes. So when Nina's book came out, I said, yes, I need to interview her. And again, the book is called Transnational Advocacy in the Digital Era: Think Global, Act Local. And we're going to talk about why she has that subtitle. So, Nina, welcome.
Thanks, Tosca. It's great to be speaking with you again today.
It is great to see your face as well. I'm really happy about that. So Nina is an assistant professor of international relations at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. Her job is based in Bologna in Italy, not in the US. Nina's research explores the role of transnational advocacy and international relations, organizations in international relations. And her book that I just mentioned came out this year, 2022, so hot off the press. She has published research on advocacy organizations and multilateral institutions, and her first book explored how UNHCR, IOM, and UNDP adapted to climate change. And that book is called Displacement, Development, and Climate Change, International Organizations Moving Beyond Their Mandates. Nina holds a PhD in international relations from the University of Oxford and a master's degree from the University of Auckland in New Zealand. She is from New Zealand. And she has also worked as a lecturer at the Hertie School of Governance in Berlin and is a co-founder of an independent think tank in New Zealand, again, her home country. Well, Nina, let's go. So Nina, when we talk about, let me just call it for now, and you can better give it a better name, but I'll call it for now digitally native campaigning platforms that are acting in some ways like traditional NGOs and in some ways not. What are we talking about? For our audience who doesn't know what the heck that is, give us some concrete examples.
Sure. And thanks, Tosca, for having me on to explain this, because as you point out, there's a huge growth in the different actors that are doing campaigning around the world. And I study one set of organizations that I find fascinating. These are groups. So those of you in the US may be familiar with Move On, Avaaz, which you've already named. And what's interesting is that Move On has sister organizations around the world. So in Australia, there's Get Up. In my home country, New Zealand, Action Station. The UK, 38 Degrees. But it goes beyond the Anglo-American world. We also have groups in South Africa, in Poland, in Hungary, in Romania, in Israel. There's groups that are setting up in Brazil. And a couple of key features, and we can get more into the details, is that these are formal organizations. They're not platforms. And I push back against the word of platform.
Why?
Because a platform sounds like it's just a thing that's online. You know, it's like a social media like Facebook. These are organizations with headquarters. So just like you can go to Oxfam headquarters, you know, back in the day when I was living in Oxford, or you can go to the headquarters of Amnesty International in London. You can go to the headquarters of 38 Degrees in the UK. And in fact, I've done that. You can go to the headquarters of Get Up in Australia in Sydney. And there is an office with permanent staff running campaigns across a range of progressive issues. So this is another key dimension. My book focuses on progressive digital advocacy organizations.
Okay.
Another key element is that all of these groups campaign across a wide range of issues. So if we think of Avaaz or Move On, it's not just climate, it's not just human rights, it's not just LGBT rights, it's not just saving a local library, it's all of those things and more.
I'm so glad, if I can just interrupt for a moment, that you corrected me right there at the top of our recording. So a couple of quick follow-up questions. So if your research focuses on professional, formally registered organizations with headquarters, with permanent staff, etc., so would you call Me Too or Fridays for the Future? Are those not fitting within your category that you research, or are they?
So they're not part of the narrower group of organizations I study, no. And the reason why not is because, Me Too, I would say, is a digital social movement. So it hasn't had, as far as I know, the formal characteristics of having a permanent headquarters and staff. Although I think often social movements develop social movement organizations over time.
Yeah.
I haven't looked at Me Too enough to understand where it is in that trajectory. Fridays for Future is a little bit different. And I would actually say I touch on Fridays for Future in the book, although it doesn't quite fit the model I'm talking about. And it doesn't fit the model because it's campaigning on one issue, climate change.
Exactly.
And it is using digital technologies, but most NGOs use digital technologies these days, What's distinct about groups like Move On, Get Up, Campact is that they survey their members and listen to them using analytic activism to determine what they're going to campaign on.
Okay, I have to stop you right there. That term analytic activism, what is that for those who don't know that in a lay terms?
Great question. In a way, an easy metaphor is Netflix, right? We go and watch, for those of you who use Netflix or Amazon, you're not sure what you want to watch at night or what you want to read. So you go on and you get a suggestion based on your previous, what you've consumed previously.
Watching behavior.
Exactly. Now, these organizations, they're not on Netflix, but they can have a similar mechanism. And that's to listen to members, not just by holding a physical meeting in the old school style of sitting around in an old hall, like a Rotary Club, but listening by virtue of what we click on, what we open. So these groups like Campact or 38 Degrees will send out regular emails, and then they'll track how many people actually open the email, which emails are open more. They'll test subject lines. So say they want to start a new campaign on climate change. They'll test a subject line that says, save the climate to save the penguins, or save the climate for your grandchildren. For instance, this is hypothetical.
Yeah.
Then they'll see which of those subject lines is more effective. And they'll test content. They even know, for instance, and I talk about this in the book, that an orange button that says donate now is more effective than a blue button that says donate now. So they can optimize in their communications, which is an important feature of these organizations, but they can also listen to what issues their members, the people that follow them on social media or via email, they can identify what issues they care about from week to week.
So just to understand, so these organizations, they test both what to campaign on, so campaigning issues, what targets to choose for their campaigning, and what messages to use in their campaigning. Is that right?
Almost. They do test issues and test tactics, but not targets. And this comes to the subtitle of the book. So while these organizations campaign across a range of progressive issues, they typically target the nation state. So they mobilize their members, both online and offline. And this is an important point because people often like, oh, it's all slacktivism, the social media, these petitions don't really work. Actually, groups like Campact have mobilized, you know, 250,000 journalists in coalition with other NGOs, other brick and mortar NGOs, to protest against free trade agreements. They did that back in 2015. And I cover some of those, what we would see as more typical forms of protest, whether it be on climate, on trade, on refugee rights. And what's important there is that those groups are mobilizing people to put pressure on their national decision makers. So they're very, in fact, I have some data on this, 98% of the time they're focused on the national level. There's a very small exception of a couple of campaigns in my data set where they might focus on the international level.
And why have they chosen to have such a singular focus on the nation state? I mean, 5 to 8 years ago would have said, well, aren't we living in an entirely globalized, interdependent world? Now, of course, you don't know with the resurgence of nationalism, et cetera. But why have these groups chosen the nation state singularly?
That was a bit of the puzzle for me. I got really fascinated by that exact question because you're right. Lots of people think we have global civil society. We're part of this international, we're all connected to international issues. They have flow on effects in terms of climate, refugees, and these groups that, you know, can digitally connect and share, it would seem obvious. The answer is they're operating in democratic societies. So I don't have any cases in authoritarian regimes. I have some in semi-authoritarian. But in those contexts, the most effective use of people power, of pressure from citizens, is on their democratically elected decision makers. And just to explain that a little bit more, all of the activists, when I shared my data about their campaigning trends and the lack of international targets, confirmed this. They see the nation state as the locus of power. And this is, if we think about big international issues, I can totally understand as an IR scholar why. If we look at the recent climate negotiations in Egypt, states are making the decision about what they'll agree to and what they'll sign up to. Say, yeah. For a refugee, if you think of the Global Compact on Migration, it's states making those agreements. And the argument here is rather than sending NGOs off to do lobbying inside these international negotiations, focus on the officials at the domestic level before they even go to those negotiations. Try and shift what's possible or monitor, ensure that international agreements are in fact implemented. So I'm not saying that there isn't any connection with international issues. I'm not saying that there's no awareness of the transnational dimensions, but what I'm saying is that they strategically see their power in mobilizing citizens to put pressure on elected decision makers.
Okay. And just so that we use the right term from here on in the interview, so how would you like me to call these organizations since you rightfully corrected me on the platform term?
Yeah, so I find it hard to have one summary. In the book, I use digital advocacy organizations because they're all organizations, they're all involved in advocacy, and the digital distinguishes them from groups that were created pre the internet era, but it is a little bit, there's more to it than the fact that they're digital because they also campaign offline. But that was offline. The easiest way I can summarize.
Yeah, and that's an important thing. And we may come back to it. Well, you've already given a very comprehensive introduction. You've touched on some things that I wanted to talk to you about. Let's look at a couple of others. So what I remember from when my team and I were doing this introductory research for us at that time is this, what makes them distinct is that because the costs of organizing and the cost of connecting and communicating, et cetera, have gone down so much with the era of the internet, that is one factor, one characteristic. Maybe I'll ask you about a second thing. One is the concept of membership is quite different from brick and mortar or traditional NGOs. So can we talk about these two aspects?
Yeah, I'm really pleased you asked about members. Because first of all, being a member of these organizations is not the same as turning up, say, to a Rotary meeting or, you know, paying a due. You know, we often think of, you know, Greenpeace or Amnesty or Oxfam would more conventionally think of members as people who are regular subscribers and receive letters and probably know that they're members, right? They've probably signed up to something. And what's fascinating about groups like Move On and Campact and 38 Degrees or Aksja Demokratia in Poland is that members are people that subscribe to the emails and will regularly engage and open those emails. So if you do it once and then never do anything, you won't generally be called a member, although there is some variation across the organizations. So you have to be returning for action, but you don't have to give any money. You don't even have to really know or tick a box to say, I'm a member of this organization. And in fact, there's fascinating research by a colleague of mine, Dana Fisher, who's gone out to some of the big marches in the US, the March for Science, the March for Women, and gone to those demos and asked people how they were made aware of them. And she finds out basically that many of them were mobilized by Move On in the US, but they didn't actually know that they weren't aware of Move On, and they didn't identify. So I think the notion of membership is very different in these organizations. And that's both a strength because they have a big, broad email list, huge, big, you know, over a million people, Americans in Move On, over a million Australians in GetUp, over a million Germans in Campact. But it's also a lot thinner, you could also argue, in terms of the engagement, the identification. In some cases, members are active and are volunteers. And I should note one thing, the membership profile is not the young profile that you might think because of their digital nature. It's mostly middle-aged baby boomers, educated, professional elites. And so actually, you know, there is some overlap potentially with the sort of people that are members of brick and mortar organizations. And these people I've seen volunteering. So when I went to GetUp, I would see volunteers, members, you know, on the front desk. In the GetUp case, they actually go out and do a lot of canvassing during election campaigns, knocking on people's doors.
Definitely offline then.
Yes. Oh, for sure. Yeah. So I think, yeah, there's two important points to be made there. One is that the members aren't always so actively engaged or identifying as members, but two, that the profile is a slightly older demographic. And I think that's a challenge for these groups going forward.
That is so interesting because one would think that these are primarily people in their 20s, late teens, 20s, 30s, maybe. Let's talk a little bit about more in depth about the profile. Is it primarily white, middle class, urban, educated? Obviously, people with internet access, which of course many people across the world still don't have, although lots of people have some access to some form of cell phone, if not a smartphone, of course. Let's talk about a little bit more in depth about the demographic profile of these members.
So you're right in terms of the typical member. They were more white, they were more middle class professionals. And many of the organizations have become aware of this problem of diversity, both amongst their staff and their members, right? Because most of the staff also fitted into that profile. And there has been a really active process in a number of the organizations to diversify both members and staff. And I mention that because I think it's probably reflective of broader conversations I know across the NGO sphere. So to give you a couple of concrete examples, GetUp is now headed up by an Aboriginal Australian woman, Larissa Baldwin. And GetUp has done, in the period I've been studying them, a lot of work to upskill and upscale their campaigning on Aboriginal rights. So hiring campaigners in the Northern Territory, so in Northern Australia, which tends to be higher density of Aboriginals living there, and people on the ground campaigning. And now, for the first time, they have at the head of their organisation an Aboriginal woman, Larissa Baldwin. In New Zealand, Action Station actually for some time has had a Māori leader. It's had two now, Laura O'Connell Ratuda and Cassie whose name, sorry, I'm just blanking on now, have been two of the executive heads of Action Station, and they've really prioritised Māori rights within the organisation. So there is starting to be some changes in terms of the diversity of those organisations.
That's interesting. Similar to what brick and mortar NGOs, many have gone through in the last 10 years or so of a big push on that. Now, it seems that these organisations are by nature very agile, right? Because they are listening for the appetite, the interest amongst members, correct? For certain campaigns and maybe less so for others. That also though makes both membership and what they campaign on very spiky, as somebody said to me in a panel a number of years ago when we, Hans and Michael and I, were part of a panel on these issues at the Interaction, the US umbrella organization for brick and mortar INGOs. Talk to me about both the pros and cons of that agility and the spikiness of campaigning and of membership.
Sure. Before I do that, I just want to add one short thing about the last question, which I wanted to mention, is that there is one organization in the Global South, which is Amandla Mobi in South Africa, that has very explicitly targeted Black working class women. Okay. So its membership base is very different, and that's had quite interesting ramifications on how they campaign and how they evaluate and get funding for their campaigns. So I would note that, because I think if we assume the model only works in Anglo democracies based on middle class people clicking emails and giving petitions, that has been a strength. But I think one of the questions for people interested in this model is, where can it go? How does it work in the Global South? And we maybe can come back to that.
I would love for you to come back to that.
Yeah. So on the spiky question, great term. Haven't heard it myself. Fast failure is another one. That may be familiar with your listeners. Mm-hmm. Essentially, the model's strength is that groups can rapidly launch new campaigns. And I've seen this in person, being inside. I did participant observation, so sitting inside the offices, watching these groups campaign. And from 1 hour to the next, they can set up a petition and set up a campaign. There's not the same sign-off procedures that you would get in a typical NGO. And they're also not setting out a yearly campaigning cycle. So I know, you know, Oxfam every year will do its, you know, inequality report for Davos, or Transparency International, World Corruption Index. These are staple parts of their work, right? And there's a set procedure. These groups, it's unlikely they would start the year out with like a calendar of like, okay, in January, February, this is what we're going to campaign on, right? They're just reacting to the news cycle, reacting to what triggers their members' interests. On the whole, there are exceptions, which we can come to. And so as a result, at least when the model was started out, it was this very reactive, which meant you could capitalize on moments of high intense interest. So right coming up to the climate negotiations or around a trade negotiation or around the refugee crisis. The weakness, though, is that as soon as member interest drops, you stop the campaign. So I have a really good case study in the book, which looks at how refugee rights issues were really high salience, high interest in September, October 2015, as many of us will recall. Yeah. And then in 38 Degrees in the UK did a whole lot of campaigning. But then when members drop interest, they switched. And they switched to saving the bees. Because bees for that organization in that context was a campaign that earned them money and that had high interest. And so the weakness of the model is precisely because it's reactive, it means you don't get sustained follow through. You don't get implementation. You're not good at agenda setting. These aren't the groups that are going to come out and say, this is the big new issue that we need to get ahead of public opinion. They're typically more reflective. And I'll pause there, but I would encourage you to ask me more about how that model has evolved, because the groups themselves are aware of that limitation.
Well, that's such a strong lead in. Why don't you go there, Nina?
The reason I'm leading you on is because I give that talk in the book, but I want to acknowledge that just like your listeners, these activists are also reflective, right? And they've come to realize that this is a limit of the model being so reactive, that they're now developing ways to do more staff stewardship, to try and marshal opinion. Larissa Baldwin is the CEO of GetUp's talked about this, you know, like we need to be creating public support for issues where there currently isn't public support, so transforming members' interests. And I give some examples in the book of where GetUp, for instance, has done that on refugee rights. So rather than just dropping refugee rights when their members lost interest, they actually had a long-term goal to get all refugees out of Manus Island and Nauru. And I also look at Action Station in a similar way, working around Māori rights in New Zealand. It's a long-term goal. And they've set it actually in part of their strategic framework. Like, this is what we're aiming for. And we're going to choose campaigns partly on whether or not they uphold the Treaty of Waitangi, which is an important foundational document in New Zealand. So I think for your listeners, what's interesting is, yes, there's a very strong rapid response model, but like anything, this model is also evolving.
Evolving based on learning about what works and where is greater effectiveness is warranted, right? So let's go a little deeper there on the term you just used, staff stewardship. And I'm going to ask you something about convergence. I remember when we did the research, you know, I remember how Greenpeace, which was on the quote unquote traditional NGO side, an early adopter, I sensed of a more what they called a people-led campaigning model rather or even paradigm, one might say, rather than a staff-led campaigning model. Is that what we're talking about? Can you unpack a little bit staff? You call it staff stewardship versus member stewardship, right? That has been evolving for quite a few. And if that's the case, second question is, are we not already looking at some symptoms of convergence between digital advocacy organizations and traditional ones?
Yeah, great question. So the distinction that I make in the book is between member-driven. And that's the analytics basis. So surveying, and you can imagine getting a report back every Monday morning and meeting as a team. Imagine you're the head of that campaign team and you get literally a list of here's the 10 top issues our members care about on Monday morning. And then you go, okay, this is what we're doing this week, right? That's a member-driven model because you know 70% of our members want us to campaign on bees. This is hypothetical. 60% care about climate. 50% care about whatever other issue. And you're like, right, let's focus on bees and climate. And that's your campaign for the week. And then the next week you come back and maybe it's a different issue. That's the member-driven model. Mm-hmm. The staff stewardship model says, okay, we have this data, but we also know we need to get refugees out of detention. And we're going to do everything we can to convince our members, even if it's not coming in our, you know, data analytics or our surveys. We're not hearing that from our members, but we're going to find ways to communicate and convince them over a longer term of the importance of that issue. So that's the difference. And For those of you listening who work on more minority rights issues, I would say that the campaigning member-driven model is not so great. Even though we're talking about progressive members, it often, in my view, in the research I've seen, is not so good on minority rights, precisely because it's a majoritarian process. Do the majority of your members think
right
on this? Whereas the staff stewardship can, over time, say, we're going to work on Indigenous rights or refugee rights, more minority issues, and try and convince a majority. Again, these are progressive members, but, you know, the progressives have a broad range of issues that they feel concerned by or triggered by. So is that enough on the distinction?
Yes, yes. But this does, to me, look like it's a symptom of some convergence between what initially these organizations, digital advocacy organizations, initially set themselves as separate from traditional NGOs, and we'll have to talk before the end of our interview also about the extent to which they try to be explicitly complementary and collaborate, mm-hmm. right, or compete. But they set themselves up as separate and in some ways as better than whether it's more agile, maybe more reflective of civic agency, in the sense that they claimed, and to some extent I think also truly enacted, a more bi-directional, two-directional way of communication between the members and the organization, and truly letting members steer, as you were saying, once again, what the organization will campaign on. But it seems that there is some convergence, also because they have moved, based on learning from offline, online, into also a number of different ways of offline organizing. I remember that change.org, you know, started to adopt somewhat later in their kind of experience cycle, if you will, where staff would engage in kind of capacity building of some of its members who were kind of seen as core members based on their activity, and supporting them with capacity building so that those members also offline started to organize. And then we get into this difference between mobilizing and organizing that Hari Han also talks about, which I think is useful. Anyway, I better stop talking and let you see where you want to jump in here.
There's a lot there to unpack.
Yeah.
The first thing I would say, for me, the really interesting dimension is how much power these organizations are willing to give over to their members. So it's not the digital dimension. And this is where, when you came to me on the title, I feel a little like frustrated in a way of the digital advocacy organization term, because all NGOs are using digital tools. It's not really useful to just say digital. And all of these digitally native organizations were also, most of them were early on, some more than others, were active offline. So if we put aside the digital and focus on who has power to choose issues, how decentralized is it? So what's interesting is that Ben Branzell, who is a key person behind this model, he worked in Move On and he helped set up a number of these organizations around the world. And one of the parts of the book that's beautiful, just going off on a small tangent, is charting how did we see this model replicate in such different cases? And part of the answer is Ben Branzell and the network, the open network that he set up. So it's a side story of organizational diffusion. But what's interesting is before Ben, having worked at Move On and having seen some other orgs set up around the world, before he launched this network, he actually tried to graft the model on to Oxfam and to a few other established NGOs.
Okay.
And it didn't work, in his words, because Oxfam and most brick and mortar NGOs have a centralized decision-making process, right? Mm-hmm. For who gets to choose issues. Oxfam's not going to devolve all of its power to its members to decide what issues to campaign on. And in many ways, I would argue neither should it necessarily, right? If we think of Human Rights Watch, it would be problematic if Human Rights Watch surveyed its members and said, should we focus on human rights abuses in Ukraine or in Ethiopia or Burma? That makes me uncomfortable because we expect Human Rights Watch to have, you know, experts on human rights and to know where to focus attention. So it's important to notice that these distinctions I'm saying are in the digital advocacy model, they're delegating a lot of power to members, but I'm not saying that everyone should follow the model, right? I'm saying this is a model that exists, that's out there, that has strengths and weaknesses. And the fact that they give their members so much power to the extent that you can start your own petition, right? So they all have their own petition platforms that you can go and set up. And just to round off, that's your point on Greenpeace. Further down the track, we have seen NGOs like Greenpeace, a first mover, in some cases, New Zealand, India, setting up petition platforms where members can start their own petitions.
Yeah,
they haven't completely devolved power, right? Greenpeace still has a certain amount of agenda-setting power in Greenpeace International or Greenpeace national charities to determine what they campaign on. And so that's really a healthy tension of thinking about how much do you give over to your members, not just to take actions, but to set the agenda versus how much do you hold it in-house.
Yeah, because your point also in the book about that the digital advocacy organizations that you study have found that certain items are more quote-unquote popular with their members than others, and that, for instance, the rights of populations that are minorities within their respective national societies are not necessarily part of that, right? Or groups that are very isolated in society, for instance, right? That are very marginalized may not come to the fore. That's an important one, I think. That doesn't mean that brick and mortar NGOs don't necessarily effectively work to promote these populations' issues, but it does mean that they can choose to do that, not based on quote unquote popularity.
Yeah. And I mean, I think this is a good launch pad for your question that you highlighted earlier about collaboration.
Okay, because let's go there.
Basically, at the early outset of these organizations, I think there was a lot of competition between traditional brick and mortar and these new groups who were often sweeping in on campaigns and in some cases claiming a victory, right? There was a case of one digital advocacy organization claiming, you know, our members got the Paris Agreement. I mean, that's blindly not true. I mean, yes, you may have contributed to a groundswell of support for climate action, but there were very bold claims that were often attributed to that one organization causing a change. So there have been tensions, and I want to acknowledge that. But where I find the most interesting part is understanding the ecology of actors. How do these new digital advocacy organizations work with traditional brick and mortars? And in one section of the book, I give some examples. So I'll talk about New Zealand and refugee rights because it hits on this exact point of you have a campaigner, a person called Murdoch Stevens, who wanted to double New Zealand's refugee quota. And New Zealand's refugee quota, which makes it extremely low, it was 750 per year, lower per capita than Australia's, right? And it hadn't been changed for many years. So he was a single issue campaigner, right? He didn't have an organization behind him. You know, he was trying to get traction. He was talking to politicians, talking to civil society. And he's written a book on campaigning. And he said in this book that he explicitly chose to partner with Action Station, the New Zealand equivalent of Move On. And he did that because rather than seeing them as a hub of expertise and passion for just one issue, he saw Action Station become something akin to the cavalry who would arrive to support a pressure campaigning just as their efforts were starting to receive mainstream attention. And he elaborated on this. He said that Action Station functioned like a floating resource for pressure campaigns that suddenly find their time in the spotlight. So the point here is that I think there can be good collaborations. He was the single issue campaigner. He developed the expertise. He knew what the target, what the ask was. He had a good, clear ask, but he didn't have thousands of people on an email list. He didn't have the infrastructure digitally to communicate, to put out an online petition, and he could collaborate with Action Station that provided that infrastructure and support. So I say that because I think there are lots of other examples out there of how these groups have at times, not all the time, but have sometimes collaborated very effectively with more issue-based traditional campaigning groups.
But yet you say, and I remember that was also the case during this time when my colleagues and I were studying these actors, you say that there is relatively rare explicit collaboration between them. Isn't that right?
So
I wonder how much is lost in terms of opportunity, because brick and mortar or traditional NGOs have expertise, as you say. They also have elite level networks and contacts, right, where they can do insider campaigning, while also needing outsider campaign. They have, when it comes to campaigns that require lots of community input, community level input and agency and support, they have built sometimes decades of trust and local credibility in communities, right? In a way that digital advocacy organizations have not. So
I'd push back on that because I think there's real variation across the organizations I study. So Action Station, having visited and seen it from a range of perspectives, talking with different civil society actors, they have developed, I think, a higher degree than most of the other organizations, their equivalents of credibility, and are very good partners, partly because New Zealand is a small country. It's a small democracy. Yeah. Yeah. And if they went out alone all the time, they would burn bridges, right? They need to form those collaborations. Okay. There's also a group in the Netherlands, actually, interestingly, De Goede Zak, which is similar. It started out with this model of our strength is not running around doing a million different campaigns, but recognizing where we can support existing campaigning groups and how we can use our infrastructure. I would acknowledge that when the model was set out, there was encouragement not to spend time as digital campaigners, sitting in long meetings and coalition talks, waiting for sign off on a campaign. That is something that the model, precisely because you're trying to respond to your members, you're not trying to respond to what other NGOs in the sector think. That could potentially be a strength or a weakness, depending on how you see it. So yes, at the outset, the model wasn't really designed for long-term collaborations with other NGOs on an issue campaign. But I would highlight that many of the organizations, Campact is another one in Germany, has been very involved in campaigns on against trade agreements and has formed large, often been one of the key groups to try and bring together and coalesce new coalitions. Okay. So I think there's more room for that model to evolve and more room for collaboration than one might think at the outset.
Okay. Gosh, there is so much that I would still like to talk about. I feel we've only barely touched on the surface. For instance, I would have liked to ask you a question about the organizational attributes of the digital advocacy organization that you have studied, but we don't have time for that. I may ask you to come back on the podcast about that. But let me squeeze in one question before I turn to you and where people can learn more about that. And that is, you study in the book progressive digital advocacy organizations. How about conservative ones? How do they are just as much a legitimate part of civil society, right? They're also citizens that organize to campaign around the issues they care about. But how would you consider them? How would you compare them with the ones that you studied in most depth?
Yeah, great question. And it's one I'm actually tackling now in a collaborative project with the Weizenbaum and the German Internet Institute, with Michael Vaughan and Annette Heft, who are much more experts, I would say, than myself on mobilizations of the right online.
Okay.
And so I would look to them for the expertise. But what we've found is that there are examples of groups emulating, of copying, copycat organizations where conservatives in the US have gone, wow, Move On's effective. Let's copy that and have a conservative version of Move On. Similarly, we've seen that in Australia with Advance Australia. There's a group in Germany. And there's an international group called Citizen Go, which is very strong, has campaigns in Portuguese and Hungarian, a bit like Avaaz, but on traditional family values and a conservative moral agenda.
Right.
Now, so they do exist. I would say two things. One, what we've found is they tend to be, from what we can see, more hierarchical, so less analytic activism. And two, those specific cases, maybe with the exception of Citizen Go, haven't been the big conservative forces online. That actually conservative groups are effective, are very good communicators and mobilizing for sure online, whether it be the Tea Party, Breitbart. But it's not an exact copy of the organizations I discuss in my book. And for those of you interested to read more about that kind of space, I would really encourage Jen Schrady, The Revolution That Wasn't. And she's got some great insights onto the differences between how the left and the right organize online. And she actually argues the right's better than the left.
Oh, good, good. I would love for you to give me outside this interview context a link to maybe one publicly available short piece by Jen Schrady's work. I think that would be really neat to include in the show notes. Well, we haven't talked about the organizational model that I want to talk. We haven't really touched in depth yet on the theory of change. We've touched upon it in several ways, but we could have gone much deeper, but we have run out of time. I feel like we've jumped around in a super interesting way, and I'm so energized by this interview, but we have to bring it to a close. So Nina, where should people go if they want to learn more about you, your new book, and the rest of your work?
Sure. A couple of examples. Obviously, the book website itself, it's just come out on Oxford University Press, and I can send that link on. There's an excerpt of it that's just been released on Stanford Social Innovation Review. So the first chunk of the book, the intro is available there. There's also, if those of you who follow Duncan Green from former Oxfam, he's done a review of it. He was one of my discussants recently in the UK. So you can get his take on the book. There'll be three initial ways.
And you're on Twitter as well. You're pretty
active. I am on Twitter, and there's a very good link on my Twitter at NinaWTH, which explains the Twitter thread on the book itself.
Oh, cool. Super. So we'll have to have all of that in the show notes. Well, thank you, Nina. As I said, super interesting, super energizing, and important, I would argue, for people listening to this podcast who work in more what you could call traditional or brick and mortar NGOs to be really taking note again of these actors as a way of comparing their own ways of organizing and campaigning, and to look for opportunities for collaboration where they can reinforce and amplify each other, and that ecology that you pointed out so rightfully. Thank you, Nina, for all your insights. And thank you, listeners. If you found this podcast stimulating the way I certainly found it, then be sure to check out in our book that I am a co-author of, Between Power and Irrelevance, The Future of Transnational NGOs, with George Mitchell and Hans-Peter Schmitz. We have a chapter on digital NGOs. Again, we are not as knowledgeable as Nina is, but we are summarizing some of the big discussions there. If you don't own the book yet, our book, or if you want to get a preview, you can access the concluding chapter through signing up for my email list on my homepage, which is 5oaksconsulting.org with the number 5. You can find this episode not just on my podcast, but also on our YouTube channel. Again, subscribe to my email list and you will always be the first to be in the know. This is Tosca, and I look forward to spending time with you next time on NGO, Soul, and Strategy. Thanks for listening to my podcast. If you valued the content, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify so that other leaders of social change organizations can find it too. And if you want to learn more, have a look at my website, 5oaksconsulting.org, where you will find blog posts, recordings of interviews with me, as well as information about my co-authored book, Between Power and Irrelevance, The Future of Transnational NGOs. If you sign up for my email list, you will receive a free sneak peek at the book. Or feel free to email me at tosca@5oaksconsulting.org. Or contact me through my website and follow me on social media, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook. Till we talk again at NGO Soul and Strategy, the podcast for NGO leaders and managers who look change right in the eye.